being able to really document your client's journey and the soft facts involved on a granular level that we weren't able to before, to really understand their goals and objectives and viewpoint and attitudes. So foundation layer, you've got your CRM. So that's number one. I would say number two, this is your intelligence and analysis tool. So something like Power BI. So it's like, how are you getting that data and turning it into actionable knowledge? So BI we use because it sits with Microsoft nicely, but if you're smart and you're using some AI or machine language to analyze behavior, that's really amazing as well. Or some of these systems and tools have these embedded in them. So that's your second one. Your third layer is like your data engagement layer. So I'm thinking stuff that your advisor and your clients interact with. So cash flow and portals for your advisor as well. Again, another thing that I can't wait to do on Power Platform, because we'll be able to build our own Power Apps and have those and control of that. And customizability is important. When we think of like, when we talk about Ningi, for example, and then being able to offer a variety of features in one system, I think that's wonderful. But for me, it's so important to be able to customize it to our firm's values and standards and the way we like to present ourselves and communicate with our clients. So yeah, 3 to 5, and integrations aren't easy, is my summary.
Can I ask about your data spine concept, Jay? So one of the, I totally agree with the approach of having that kind of underlying data, foundational, whatever you want to call it. Spine is a great word for it, actually, I like that. Yep. But one of the challenges with it will be that every system is going to have some data that only that system will ever need, right? So it could be your risk profiling system has answers to every single risk question that the client went through the questionnaire and filled out. That, I mean, you could put that into your overall data model, but you probably don't need to, and it's a lot of effort and blah, blah, blah. So where do you stop with building out that spine? You know, do you just do like the really core client data that every app is going to need, or do you go further than that so that you can have the ability to analyze data that might only be in certain systems, and but you're pulling it into your spine anyway? Or so how far do you take it?
Yeah, no, I know all. Like, this is our gold, actually. So yeah, I want to put, so it's like, how easy is it to export that data? How much control do we have over that data as well, if it's owned by a third party tool? All of those things to bring into consideration. How can we easily move that across the unstructured format of it? Yeah, as much as I get what you're saying, and it is a really tricky one, especially when you want it to, the flow to start from your central system. But hey, if that feature is controlled by a third party tool and sits on top of that, then it's kind of monitoring how often and how that's maintained, and if that's automatic, which I want it to be.
I completely agree. I mean, that's the vision, right? You want access to all of your firm's data, not just part of it. But that means that every provider has to give you access to all of the data, and you've got to build a really comprehensive integration. So it's the right place to aim, absolutely. It's just a really challenging thing to achieve.
Well, I mean, on that subject, and I think this needs to be another forum in the near future. The good news is the Data Use and Access Act did get the royal assent on the 12th of June. And that is fundamentally going to transform access to information from organizations of all types. We are still waiting. The Secretary of State has got to come out with the secondary legislation and identify a timescale. But just for those that are not aware of the Act, it is basically one of the many things it's doing. Revising GDPR. There is a somewhat we now have, or will have in the UK, a rather diluted version of GDPR. Pressure in terms of responding to, there's more latitude in the reasonableness of requests. People can't ask for every last thing from you in a subject access request. What's most important to this is it's extending the consent model across all industries, by the way. This is not just financial services legislation. This is legislation that has been introduced as part of the government's smart data initiative. And I think it's really important when I say there's government support about it, it's more accurate to say there's civil service support. You know, this is something that was originally proposed in the Johnson administration. They didn't get the legislation through in time before he called an election. You know, then it came up again and it didn't get through before election. And it's very clearly been prioritised. It wasn't announced in the King's, well, it wasn't in the detail of the King's speech, and then they slipped it in the press releases, and it's been fast-tracked through the House of Lords. It's now law. What that will mean in future is that if an organisation holds your data once the secondary legislation is brought in, but that's the whole point. I think, to be fair, government has learned from the pension dashboard fiasco that they needed to introduce a new pension bill to force all the pension providers to support, because they all turned around and basically said, we're not going to do it until you make us do it by law. So what they've done now with this legislation is it covers all industries, and what they need to do is bring in industry-specific rules, but that only needs secondary legislation. So you're talking about statutory instrument. It could happen in 3 months. But what it will mean, and we don't know yet, if there will be an exemption for small businesses. There's none stated in the legislation. So this could also be a risk for advisors to think about. Basically, if you hold data on people, they are entitled as citizens to ask you to send their data to whoever they want to see it. So, by the way, good news is this legislation kills off the letter of authority problem. Because if an insurer refuses to give you the information digitally, well, the fine's only 4% of global turnover, so who would worry about that? It will be transformational. Can I pose a slightly different question to you both? It's long been a belief of mine. Indeed, we did a piece of work back in 2010. Where we looked back to 1995 and forward to 2025 at the shape of advice businesses. And our hypothesis was that an advice firm that was 100 people in 1995 would probably have had about two IT people. And that by 2025, we would see advice businesses that had two doctorate level financial planners and about 98 people in other digital roles. We didn't call it other digital roles then, but actually, and I'm beginning, those businesses now exist. It's not as prevalent as it, I think it will be in the future. My question is this, I mean, I see the future as one where the most important thing will be what you put in front of your customer. And we won't talk about digital anymore. There is a point, and we're probably no more than 5 or 10 years away, where the most important system will be, or maybe it is already, what you put in front of your customer. And actually, you know, everything else will sit behind. So what I'm waiting to see, I think the system that's got the most potential in the long term is who actually turns around and says, no, we're going to launch something entirely different that is focused on sharing everything with the customer, and then we'll work it all backwards. So is my vision too far, or do you think we could end up in that scenario? And when should firms start planning that what they put in front of the customer is the most important piece of tech in their business? Because I don't think it is right now.
I completely agree. Shall I go first? I think you're absolutely right. I think if you look at what's going on, or has been going on for decades in other industries, the product or the proposition or whatever you want to call it, the thing you are selling is what's in front of the customer, right? So look at Amazon. Granted, it's selling books and widgets and all sorts of things, but the experience of Amazon is the Amazon app and it's the Amazon website. It's not the customer service. You barely ever interact with that. If you look at banking, right, my experience, it's not the same for everyone yet, but my experience of banking is the Monzo app. That's all I think about when I think of Monzo the bank. I don't think about what are their operational processes or how good's their customer support when I call them up, because I don't call them up. I think the same should have been true for a while in our industry, but we're so far behind in this and many other things that it's not. But yeah, absolutely, the client is only going to experience what you put in front of them in terms of the tech and what you put in front of them in terms of the people, if you're putting any people in front of them, if we're really rolling the clock forward. But I know it's a controversial take. So the client experience technology has to be fantastic if we're going to transform this industry and compete and differentiate against all the other advice firms that aren't working on that stuff. And frankly, the client experience technology that is currently available is pretty awful compared to other industries. I mean, you know, Intellifone has a portal, does the job, I suppose. Money Info does the job, I suppose. There are a few others out there, but they're pretty limited in market share. So yeah, why aren't we doing better at this? I really don't get it.
Okay, let's have a look. Okay, obviously 100% I agree. And there's such a deep call for deeper, more accessible digital tools available to clients. And I love this idea that really their engagement with it is where we capture richer fact find, because I think that's where everyone is lacking a little bit and we can definitely improve. And that fact find is supported through, the AI and the tech, that the technology that's available to us now. Okay, so there's that. But when I think of advice as well, and I was looking through the Landcat report sadly last night, and like reviewing again, it's like, what do people value and love the most? And what do they get from having an advisor? Is that this relationship, this confidence, reassurance, and trust. So if we can find tools that help an advisor enhance that, those things. So it's not just this interface, and because I don't want to take out like the magic, right? There's some magic that happens, and this connection and relationship, when I talk to our advisors who have had clients for over 20 years and they're friends, and this is where they get their confidence from, and that when this wealth transfer happens between spouses as well, that that relationship and that deep reassurance and that connection is where that real value from the advice is getting. Because yes, we're already seeing from banking apps and stuff like this, low levels of advice being, given, and cool apps. Like, I don't know if you saw like Foster De Nova's app, like this, it's called like Map, My Advice Place. Did anyone see that come out? Very clever, very fun. Like, I want to use it. And then there's things like Plum and stuff. There's like a million alternatives like this, which are great. And I think we should all be harnessing, but I think we should be embedding them in this hybrid zone of a human advisor. I'm all for, I'm still, I have to, as much as my role is all AI and tech, it's like, no, but how am I doing that? As it has to be a support. And we have to find and keep accentuating, emphasizing the role and that the human touch points and those moments for deep human connection, and then just how those digital interfaces help support that. So we need to be using them in a different way just to enhance those deeper, lovely things, is what I'm trying to say. I didn't, that came out clearly.
Great. Now, we've talked about all the various options. Are there any systems that advisors should be more careful than others in replacing? And let me give you an example. I know from conversations with the FCA, but I was having a conversation with them a couple of years ago where we were talking about various systems, and I shared a view that really, if an advisor is going to switch risk profiling system, they need to re-advise all their clients. And the really interesting thing was, two people at the FCA in harmony both turned around and said, yes, we think that through. Now, what I think is irrelevant, what they think is incredibly relevant. But are there any, that's an example that I think firms really need to be clear and think through the implications. Are there any other systems in the stack, or if there are multiple, what particular systems in the stack do you think it's really important to be careful about changing?
Hey, do you want to go first this time? I feel like I'm always speaking first. Oh, and just as I say that, I think she's frozen. I guess I'll go first.
Oh, you're back.
Oh, there we go.
Am I back? I'm back. Okay. So, thanks, Tim. Yeah, the obvious, you know, if you're changing your cash flow or your risk tolerance tools. Am I frozen again?
No, you're okay.
Okay, wonderful. Or if you're moving assets to a new platform, all of these things, yes, definitely 100%, you should be re-advising. But then also if you're doing something that doesn't seem so obvious, like you are changing your CRM, maybe there's like updated privacy notice and you need to get fresh consent and look again at where the data is being held and how it's being used. I am all for as much communication and transparency around the tools that we're using, especially now that there's AI deeply embedded in more and more things. So if you're using like Planner, for example, or IO have done all this stuff where they're baking in AI into the system, all of that needs to be communicated and shared. So as part of that process, and it's something that I'm thinking about as we get ready to move and as we are integrating new tools all the time, is are you mapping your client outcomes and how those could change? And are you aware of how that affects different segments of your clients and clients in different and vulnerable circumstances as well? Maybe a good way to do it, I'm just thinking in terms of strategy here, is running both your systems in parallel and then doing kind of a 360 assessment, getting different members across your firm involved in that assessment and looking at those observations and track those outcomes, track them and the lessons that you've learned and your complaints, so you can pop them in your next annual consumer duty report as well. That's very important to do and gather your lessons as you're going along, especially when you're testing and trying a lot of different things, which we are a little bit guilty of, but actually that's very fun and learning a lot as we go along. So yeah, I think it's applicable to everything, and you won't know unless you do a proper assessment.
Tim, let you come in on that one.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, actually. I think in terms of the core of the question, when do you need to re-advise a client, there's three lenses to look at it through. There's the regulatory lens, which is the obvious one. You know, it, like we said, if a new system is going to lead to a different investment strategy or asset allocation or risk profiling approach or something really obviously regulatory, then you do have to re-advise those clients. The second lens is operational, or maybe propositional. If a change in system means that you're delivering a different service to that client, maybe because added steps into a workflow that mean you're going to be providing something new to that client, or taking something, maybe more importantly, taking something away that they got before, then you've absolutely got to, at the very least, bear that in mind. If it's materially worse, then again, you probably need to, well, it might not be a case of re-advising because you'd just be advising them on the thing that is materially worse. So maybe it's just a case of telling them, we've changed this, and you know, therefore you need to reassess whether we're the right firm for you or whether you're happy with what you're paying for. Or I think the point is you've got to be transparent about it. And then the third lens is sort of the ethical one, which is quite similar really, but it's you know, if you are changing something that is different for that client, you sort of just owe it to the client to have a conversation with them, right? The difficulty in all of that is that regulation in particular, but any of those factors, shouldn't hold back innovation. And I know regulation, some people at least think that regulation often holds back innovation, which is a real shame, because that's not what it's there to do, I don't believe. But, you know, if you choose to not change systems and stick with something that you know is worse just because you know you also know that you'd have to re-advise your clients, then you know that's it's a huge missed opportunity. So I think the question becomes, can we switch systems without re-advising by being very careful about it? So for example, by ensuring that the risk profiling outcomes match from old system to new. If you can do that, fantastic, or at least within an acceptable tolerance, like, I don't know, 95% or something. And as long as you document those decisions, like Jay says, for your consumer duty report, but also just so that if the regulator comes calling and say, you switch systems, did you think about that very carefully and apply tolerances and check what the outcomes for your clients would be, et cetera, you can say, yes, we did that, and we chose to move ahead. So yeah, I think, with care, you can absolutely switch systems and not disadvantage clients, but it does take that care.
Okay, great. Can I come on to a related subject? Because we've talked about a lot about people adding various AIs. what guidance would you give people before you? I mean, my first one is, if anything's free, don't use it. Because the reality is, if something is free, you're the product, and they're absolutely going to be training what they're doing on your system. But what else? I mean, that's just a starter. What are the things that people should be thinking long and hard about, candidly, before they turn the let these AIs loose on their client data?
Your client data is so precious, and everyone is going to be so excited about all the new tools that are available on the market, from really the baseline of like Gamma and fun presentation tools of, you know, being able to make your client documentation more engaging. So your suitability letters or your pre-sale reports, people are going to want to be throwing this stuff into like Napkin and Gamma and Presentation AI and all of this. You know, you've probably seen the long LinkedIn posts of different ways of, you know, now making a PowerPoint presentation really jazzy. So what am I trying to say is, you need someone actually having strong governance and who's going to take responsibility, which is why I'm glad this is actually a big part of my role, is someone who's going to do the proper due diligence and monitor usage and be a voice of yes and no, you can't use that. Start there, have someone who is, this is their bread and butter, and it is their main concern that we're only using secure systems where your data isn't being trained on. You know where it's being stored. Do you have a strong AI policy in-house? Do you have an AI policy that's visible to your clients? Do you have internal due diligence checklists and documents, and then client-friendly facing ones? Are your advisors able to gain consent? They can't gain consent if they can't explain what's happening, what the AI is doing, and how we're using it. So we've got your meeting notes. We're recording this meeting. It's not good enough. You need to be able to explain, the advisor needs to be able to explain, it doesn't have to be deeply technical, but it's how we're using your data. What value is it bringing to you? What are the outcomes that are available to you? Do we have a clear opt-out method and route? And is that going to have any negative implications on other clients, different segments of clients like we've talked about? That is so important. I'll give an example. So Pension Lab that we're using, some of you have heard of it, to help digitize the whole LOA thing. We started to use the AI feature that's kind of just being launched now. But even so, digitizing it has had huge ramifications on our workflows and the client engagement with it. Clients were signing paper LOAs before. This is a whole different experience for them that we have to really deeply consider and consider the outcomes for. So, okay, safety, security, due diligence, huge thing. Upskilling and training your team and making them feel comfortable and creating this a new wrapper around contextualizing AI and where it sits within your firm and advice and how it's going to impact their roles. Massive. Can you put your hand up, put a little hand up if you're using any AI to help with your suitability letter reports and generating them?